words that are important to this. And the first one is the word that appears in the Gospel of Thomas, monachos. It's a Greek word, and when you see the original Coptic of the Gospel of Thomas, this word comes up over and over again. And we get the word monastic from this word. And the word monastic is the kind of description of a intentional life of spirit that Christianity sought to develop. Yeshua, Jesus, used the word monachos, obviously, in some way, probably in Aramaic. And the word maybe in Aramaic is kehedaya, which means single or united, and monachos means something very much similar. That idea we'll return to this morning, but the word monachos, kehedaya, created this sense of spirituality in Christianity that we call monasticism. So as an order, we are monastics, but we're doing it in a very different way. We're not enclosed, we're not cloistered, nor are we hermits. So there's two
speak
forms.
For yourself.
You're both cloistered and a hermit. You know, these Arkansas people, they'll do it. They'll run into the hills, marry somebody, and
never be seen again.
Never be seen again. There was a tradition, both East and West, to get those that were intentional about their spiritual life to enclose them in monastic communities, to close them off. There was a lot of different reasons for that, good reasons and some bad. But that experiment has run its course, and we, as members of this order, are following a different pattern, another heretical imperative. Paul Evdokimov was a Russian monastic, but he expressed in the 20th century, a very different viewpoint. He believed and he saw that this deep intention should not be tied necessarily to a cloister or an organization per se, that it had to be interiorized, that the intentionality and the spirit of monachos needed to be reclaimed by each individual and made an interior reality. And he wrote beautifully about this idea, and we have it on our website. It's called Interiorized Monasticism. Very close to the way Yeshua talked about interiorized Judaism. Those are parallel ideas. That Judaism, as Amir was using the word exoteric, is not just about the rules on the outside, like monasticism was about rules and a rule of life that was imposed from without. It had to be brought within. So this interiorization, this movement toward the interior, is definitely what Paul Evdokimov talked about, which is the way we are describing our form of monastic tradition. We, each of us, interiorize and personalize and make it our own. So our rule of life reflects this essence. And that's why we return to it, because the order is not imposing upon you a standard rule, which is what would happen if you went into a monastic community. You are responsible. You have the responsibility of creating a monastic space inside yourself and in your world. And this is the other characteristic, that we are trying to establish stability both inwardly and in a chaotic world. This is one of the reasons why cloistered communities were so important in very difficult times. So when Rome fell, Christianity kind of circled the wagons into monastic communities to keep some semblance of order in the chaos. And that happened in the East too. So stabilitas, stability in a chaotic world, is one of the reasons why cloistered communities of spiritual intention were created. But we don't really have that luxury, or we don't know if it's a luxury. We just know that what we're called to do is to create stability in our own space to the degree that we can. This is a very difficult planet. It's a very difficult place to create stability in chaos. So order in chaos is what partly a rule of life is about. How do you make order? How do you create order out of the messiness of life that you experience? And that's why we have to revisit it, because it's like canoeing. How do you stay stable on a flowing river? Well, if you say, I'm always going to go at this pace with these paddles, well, up ahead there's going to be rapids. And you can't keep that pace. You have to change your pace in order to keep your canoe afloat in this instability. So a canoe is a stabilitas in an unstable flowing environment. That's what we're doing. And that's why thinking about the rule of life in that way is so important. But that's what it is. How do I maintain inward stability and outward to the degree that I can to keep my boat from sinking in the middle of this chaos?
Lynn, since you're using a river analogy, may I say that in river science, we talk about dynamic stability.
Exactly.
So stability can imply non
rigid
whatsoever, rigidity.
Right.
But real stability is in a chaotic setting.
Perfect.
It has to be dynamic.
Dynamic stability. So if you think of the rule of life as dynamic stability, that's precisely the right metaphor. And that's why we need it. I need to think intentionally about this in my particular environment, which is frankly unstable. It changes all the time. And you keep thinking, oh, well, it'll settle down. There's a word in English in Texas called bullshit, and it applies to this particular. It doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen. There are stabilities, but that is, we have to, as interiorized monks in the world, create that. And so we have a responsibility to this, and this allows us to become something more than simply reactors. And we put this idea very much to the fore, that we serve as priests to the world, and that our monastic intention is about our own inner space, the interiorization of life, and stability in the outer world. So what? So that we can serve the world.
If I might just add another word to that, just came to mind. It also gives us empowerment.
It does. Good for you. So this, are we weak? Are we strong? We're certainly weak. We always feel inadequate, unable to completely meet the challenge of the world. Nobody feels completely empowered. And yet, the ability not to be undone and to be able to respond with some degree of power in the world in the right way. All of these are considerations of what a rule of life is about. So, three words. The third word is this. Sapience, wisdom. That we're attempting to create a wisdom form versus a religious form. Not that the two don't have connection to one another. And the word religion is not a bad word even in itself, because what religion actually means etymologically is to tie, to yoke. It's almost like the word yoga. To tie and to yoke and to create stability. But because this is inward yoking and inward stability, what we are attempting is to embody sapience. Because we know that this world has plenty of information. It's overwhelmed with data. But it does not necessarily have what we may call integral knowledge at its heart. It is not doing a very good job of integrating. And so wisdom is integral knowledge. It's meaning the ability to connect the dots and to make, to draw in enough insight and perspective in order to create something more than simply more information. So wisdom is about living in such a way that what is made available to the world is wise and balanced and visionary. So this is like riding a bicycle and chewing gum. You know, there's a lot of things to do, and you have to keep the inner and outer, and there's all kinds of forces. This is not easy. So a rule of life is a kind of guideline. You think of it as a kind of, all right, I need a guiding principle, and it has to reflect my own unique place on the planet and in space and time. And so what I'm attempting is this this inward awareness, intentionality, a monastic intentionality. We'll come back to it. I'm attempting stability in a chaotic world, dynamic stability. I'm attempting to bring to bear wisdom, which is a powerful force, as Karen has just said. Those are the things the rule of life is about. So to help me understand, or to help me keep enough of the pieces in place that I don't kind of fragment and lose my way across this very difficult journey on the planet, I have tried to think of this dynamically, and to think of it, and I like to think in pictures, and I like to think in such a way that diagrammatically I can put pieces into place. I have created this little diagram, and I mentioned it yesterday, that might put enough of the pieces in place that we have a sense, okay, I have the bigger picture, and I don't have to be completely overwhelmed by myriads of details. I can kind of put it all together, and this might be a way of thinking about all of this that we are trying to integrate in an unstable world as an interior dimension that affects the outer world. I have more copies. So, everyone, yeah. So before we disperse, which we will this morning to talk specifically about our rule of life, this diagram perhaps can help us understand something of what all of this might be about. Because our rule of life should reflect something more than the abbot saying, okay, you got to do X. No, that won't work. It's too dynamic. And that just goes back to the old form, which says, okay, the abbot is going to impose strict discipline on your life. That's not the way we work. We're not working that way. We're creating an alternative. And the alternative puts a lot of responsibility on the individual monk. So here's my take, my way of thinking about creating, and here's what I think we're doing in an alternate way, is creating a form of wisdom Christianity, as opposed to any other word we want that. We want to represent that as monks and priests to the world. So what does that mean? Well, it may look like, and this is contempling wisdom. So when you think, just go to the top, contemplative wisdom, the word contemplative is co-templing. Contemplating is wisdom that creates a temple. It's a temple in which the divine and the human can dwell. So it's a contemplative space in which the human and the divine come together, and there is this integration between heaven and earth, between human and divine, that is in fact what we're about. And hopefully what we're restoring to the vision of Christianity is this original sense of the contemplative. The temple is not external in Jerusalem, it's inside, as I think Jesus taught. So that's the direction that we're headed. If you thought of this as a mandala, it would be good. The word mandala, however, does not appear in the New Testament. And so you have to think of a mandala using another tradition. I picked up this beautiful mandala in Chennai. Is that right? No, I picked it up in Mysore. This is a Buddhist mandala. And we went to visit a Tibetan community, beautiful, wonderful experience in central India, south central India, and we got to see mandalas all over the place. And I've always been attracted to this. I'm going to send this around to this image of a mandala. You have a mandala in front of you, and this is very similar. And what I intuitively thought turned out to be correct. When we went into the big hall in which the Dalai Lama meets with his community, when he goes to that place that we visited, there was a mandalas all over the walls, but then there was a 3D mandala. And I'd always thought mandalas were 3D. And sure enough, they are. Usually what we do is we look down on a mandala and we see the squares and circles. It's a circled square, or the square circled. That's what a mandala basically means. There's circles and squares, heaven and earth, okay? Circle, the celestial divine, infinite, and then the four sides of earth as we experience them, and the dimensions of earth, and the dimensions of space, the dimensions of time. Those are married together, and I saw, and I've got a picture of it, a beautifully, like a wedding cake, a mandala built like this, and I thought, that's it. And I just couldn't stop taking pictures of it, because it was this basic form with all these side porches and directions and colors and dimensions, and it was just layered and stacked along the vertical axis. And I thought, oh man, that's it. The Buddhists did it, and we get to see it. So this is a mandala, just and so is this. This is a Abrahamic mandala, or something like that. So to think of this mandala in this particular way, what I would like for you to do is to imagine it as a diagram of what a rule of life is attempting to integrate. So the first integration that we are attempting, and that's a personal integration. I can't do it for you. You have to do it for yourself. There is no abbot rule, no order rule that's going to make this possible. But the first integration is the universal integration of what we perhaps should call universal wisdom, Sophia Perennis. That we honor universal wisdom. That the divine has provided a universal perspective. And this perspective is shared. It's a shared perspective around the planet. It is a primordial, perennial gift that the divine has made of teaching, of understanding, of insight, of perspective. And we share with all the great sacred traditions this first frame. We all acknowledge that the divine is speaking and leading, and that Sophia is guiding us. And that first integration is the teaching that is called Sanatana Dharma in the Hindu world. It's called Hekmat in the Islamic world, Chokhmah in the Jewish world, Sophia in the Christian world, on and on and on. That word basically says there is a universal form, and the form of wisdom that the divine is teaching, that Sophia is teaching us, connects to these basic issues. The basic issues are these. It's multicultural. It's answering the four fundamental questions. And it was great to hear Amir say it without prompting. Who are you? First question. Top. Who are you? Really, who are you? It's personal, it's practical. Left side, number two, where did you come from? What is your source? Are you simply a product of space, time? Or are you an eternal creature? And wisdom will say, it's too narrow to think of yourself as only temporal and only terrestrial. So there's a whole Dharma teaching, whole wisdom teaching, on that side of the mandala about your origins. Jesus is right in the middle of that teaching. At the bottom of it is number three, the great wisdom teaching. What in the hell are you doing on this planet? What is that about? And number four, the right-hand side, is the great Dharma teaching, the great wisdom teaching of where is this taking you? What is this experience? What is it leading to? What's the ultimate destiny of humankind and you in the midst of humankind? Those are great Sophianic teachings. And you are busily living those. You are busily making those a part of your personal experience. So the stability that you have, and I see this original frame is the great stabilizing factor. If I forget my origins, if I forget why I'm on the planet, if I forget who I really am, and if I forget what I'm actually going, I will get lost in Waxahachie at 7-Eleven. And it won't be, I will become unstable. So that is the first frame. The second frame, which we have been celebrating with Amir in his own unique and particular vision, but we share it, is what we might call the traditional Abrahamic, or in our case, maybe to think of it as the Jewish frame. Jewish wisdom. The original form of Sophia Perennis for us is filtered through Jewish wisdom. And Jewish wisdom is an ancient form of wisdom that is as old as any of the great traditions of the earth. It's 5,000-6,000 year old wisdom of walking across the planet, being knocked about, living through almost every ancient civilization except for the Chinese, being forced to deal with the world in all of its complications, having to hammer out an understanding of both divine reality and personal reality on the anvil of space and time. That's Jewish wisdom. And it's a heritage. And we inherit that. And that is what is given to us. And that is what Jesus is speaking from. In the middle of that experience, all across the planet, there was what we call the enlightenment of the Axial Age, which simply upended the viewpoint that the divine was our, was made in our image. We thought the divine was like we were, and then we were told and taught at the axial age, no, the divine transcends everything, and then that divine transcendence is inside of us imminently. And that was the enlightenment step. And that enlightenment step in Jewish wisdom created three things. It had created the prophetic visionary viewpoint of the universe. It created the great cosmological vision. It created mystical tradition for the Jewish world. So the prophetic, the cosmological, and the wisdom is what Jesus inherited. He inherited from his world, Jewish experience, he inherited those three. He inherited the enlightenment, the prophetic, the Sophianic, and the mystical, and that became what later we knew as Kabbalistic Judaism, but early Kabbalism was what Jesus taught from. And what's so interesting to me is to go back to the roots of Jewish Jesus tradition and find the roots of Kabbalah. And that is now being seen pretty clearly, I think. So, but that's because of the Enlightenment. That's because this breakthrough into transcendence and all the other things that happened after that, having to do with Alexander the Great and all kinds of other things that just stirred the pot. Until we get to Jesus, and the Romans are in there tromping through the tulips, and Jesus is having to create wisdom in a chaotic world, and he does it. And so he does it for us, meaning he takes that trauma, the trauma of the Jewish world, and he turns it into something that's really valuable, and he sees things. And so I put the two Y's. This is the YY axis. I'm thinking more like this today. Yeshua and Yaakov, the two brothers. They create a form of contemplative wisdom that is applicable to their chaotic world. And that's visionary, it's prophetic, it's practical. It is a gift made to us that has something to do with the difficult world, and yet it's visionary, it's cosmological, it's definitely a wisdom, but what's so great about it, it's also very practical. And so Jewish wisdom sort of has these two poles, visionary and cosmological and practical. And so you hear both in both brothers, but Yeshua leads the charge, Yaakov, James follows, and out of that comes a particular kind of Christian, ultimately, wisdom that is, and here's the circle that I would call the teaching of oneness, monachos, singleness, non-duality, unitive understanding. Nothing is left out. So, oneness, singleness, non-duality, a very advanced form of wisdom, which Jesus pioneers for us in his own unique way. And that is what monachos means. You too, he says, must become monachos, united, unfragmented. It is our work. It is our way. And it is shared. It's a shared spirituality. What's, I think, maybe unique to Jesus is he picks up this image and he really works with it, which is the cardinal core of unitive understanding, that you can't be stable in the chaotic world, you can't be unfragmented without a stable heart that is operative. So the way I think Cynthia would say it, the basic operating system for us is the cardial center. And Jesus taught to that center. That was his contribution to understanding what's at the driving force of this stability is this cardial center. And that has to be operative. A computer is a great thing, but if the operating system isn't working, it's just a piece of crap. It won't serve you. So for us, the heart chakra is for the Semitic traditions and for Jesus in particular, the heart chakra is the driving force, if you use chakra systems as a way of thinking, of this energy, this power. So how to operate cardially, how to operate and use that energy, and the film was great because it hinted that we put so much emphasis on the rational mind, and it may not be the driving force of a human being. It's certainly a contributor, but it may not be the center. So the awareness in the of Yeshua that this is the driving force in the center, and it is the thing that unites heaven and earth, the human and the divine. So this theanthroposophy, this great theandric, the uniting of theos, divine and human, anthropos, brought together in this beautiful balance, is Jewish wisdom. So the sign of that is perhaps this brilliant star that really shines when the human and the divine, when the heaven and earth are brought together in balance. And that can only take place at the level of the heart. So this is, yes.
Well, the chakra system, the lower three chakras are more physical, more human, and the upper three are more subtle, divine, and the heart is the balance.
Good, perfect. So we're in sync. See, this is this perennial wisdom percolating through the different systems, reaching a kind of understanding, a common understanding. We can talk now across traditions. When we were in India, we used a lot of these ideas, and we realize we're on the same page, pretty much. Yeah.
Then maybe you'll get to this, but this, like most of the things we talk about in spirituality and religion and so forth, stops before the enlightenment, our current enlightenment. I can't dismiss the last 500 years.
No, I can't either, and I don't want to. It has to be integrated. So what we're busy doing is integrating the contribution of modern Western tradition to ancient Sophianic tradition. We don't want those to be split apart either. That's part of the integration. We're the ones that get to do that. We're Western educated. We're rationally aware. We're historically present. We see the world in these ways. We see it ecologically. We see it as a system. We are now able to connect to the.
Is there a way to show that on the mind?
I don't know. I think if you did a 3D one, yes, for sure. And maybe the sphere is the cosmos and the earth and everything round. And you put it in there.
Your point too, though, connects there. Where did you come from?
Yes.
So you partly would come from
the Western tradition.
Western enlightenment. Yeah.
That's true. Yeah. And another way to do it, for me, Jim, is to do this. In the middle, and because this is a flat surface, usually represented this way, you have, in my experience, you have this biaxial experience, or triaxial. I even like that better when it's three-dimensional. I am moving across time and space. I have my own personal historical experience, and then I have my own unique relationship to the societal and the the civilizational aspect. I'm a Westerner, I'm an American, I'm a Texan, I'm a male, I have all these things that are part of my unique experience. In the middle of that, I have my connection to the vertical axis. So I am integrating, I'm busy integrating my own unique connection to time and space, and to world, and to history, and to the earth, and to the cosmos, and to tradition. It has to be inside of me. So that diagram for me, the middle there, is where I am a nexus for this integration. So that's why I put the cross there. That's not the cross that Jesus died on necessarily, except maybe he's dying on my cross. That's probably true. But that idea that there is this multi-axial space inside of me where the integrations are made, and I can't do it for you, and you can't do it for me.
Jim,
I have to do it.
May I add something there for Jim that made me connect to, and then your explanation, is that what I'm personally sort of constantly challenged with is taking what history gave us as an either or. You either believe this or you believe that. And we're at a place in time that I'm one of the first ones called to transform it to both and.
Yeah.
And that it's like the beginning in the movie when they were talking about science, we talked about it in our group, that shows the science things that now were proven ridiculous.
Yeah,
and they got the doctors smoking.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, that we believed were true at that time, and then we've already come to see it differently.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how I am personally processing that integration.
Yeah. Good.
It's both.
It is. And here's we're all doing it because we're all, this is Oriental Orthodox order in the West, and we're all Westerners. We've been trained by science. I'm trained as a philosopher by science, by a kind of scientific methodology, especially having to do with hermeneutics. I have received the stamp of Western tradition on that. I think as a Westerner. I think about historical, critical analysis of texts. When I get the Gospel of Thomas, I don't look at it as just a nice little piece of literature. I look at it historically, critically. Why? Because I've been trained by the West. And we're all doing that. It may be implicit. We may not even bring it to the surface of our mind, but we're doing it all the time. And we have to do it. That's part of our integration.
This is would be a footnote or a side note. And so just take it and then drop it.
Do it. Go.
A mirror comes to us not using historical critical methodologies.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Good point. And you picked up, we'll reflect on this tonight because we need to reflect on what we were listening to a musician, an artist, but he is also technically trained. I don't know if you know that he has a whole technical side to him. And I forget what the name of it is, but it's
micromechanical.
For God's sake.
Really? And, what's smaller than
okay.
Micro?
But I put here, I put a little star and crescent just to remind ourselves of the Abrahamic connection, that the star and the crescent is the Islamic symbol of radiated light and reflected light. They have worked with these images and they're beautiful, and we are benefiting from the experiment from the Prophet Muhammad up to the present moment of this imminent experience of the divine as the divine beloved that Yeshua started to explain as the bridal chamber, that when that experience really takes hold, there is light. There is reflected light and radiant light. Okay, just let that be a kind of metaphor for, I think, what the Sufi tradition contributes maybe to us. I just didn't want to leave it out. And it's certainly a part of my life. And we have experienced it here together this weekend. So if we said the frame of Jewish Israeli Abrahamic wisdom integrated by Yeshua and Yaakov as a kind of singleness in which the human and the divine, heaven and earth are brought together at the level of our own experience, and we are gifted with light. Okay, that might be a nice way of putting all of this mandala together.
One observation, I've mentioned this in this group before, but I've not really looked at the numbers, but when you just go by the biographies of the people who developed modern science, I think there is a disproportionate number of Jewish people that did that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, boy, no, that's a good point.
So I think...
Yeah, you know, they did that in spades. Yeah, the Jewish world did it in spades and gifted us, because they're old. I mean, they're the old souls on the planet. Mm-hmm. They're part of the old souls on the planet. And you know, that's a continuing gift. Mm-hmm. I mean, Einstein, for good sake, was a Jew. And we got to think about that, yes.
I just want to make a comment. What you were talking about, the reflective and radiant light, I wonder if that's not, that can be me both ways.
Both ways. I believe it. I believe it. That's exactly it. Those are another integration. I am both radiant light, as St. Simon the New Theologian said, you are to burst into flame, and you're a radiation of the ultimate source of light. Moon-like in your radiance. You're both star-like in your radiance and moon-like in your radiance. So sun and moon in the Islamic world talk about light as being available in different ways, inwardly.
Well,
yes.
This is a little off track, but so the star of Judaism that we associate with Judaism and the crescent moon that we associate with Islam, how far back do those images go? Because it had never occurred to me that we're talking radiant and reflective light until you just said it. So does that bubble up out of the wisdom of the...
It does.
I mean,
it's,
you know,
the
imagery's there, but it never occurred to me that's what we were talking about until you just said that. And that's pretty stunning to me.
It is. And I think this is... I wouldn't... These are my own integrations of things, but I hear them in the Psalms, I hear them in Rumi, I hear them in Jesus' teaching. They're just everywhere. Mm-hmm. And that's part of our work, is to, as wise beings, to draw things together in this particular way. When we were in India, I bought this, and I didn't have a good one until I found this in India. This is a silk miniature, a Persian silk miniature, which basically says, at the center of this is my own life story. It's as unique as this picture. It's small, little details. In fact, if you look at it, a single hair creates some of these images in this. It's one of the beautiful things that Iran gave to the world. But it's exquisite, and it's detailed, and it's granular, and it's unique, and it's a story, it's a narrative. This is an example. Every single one of us at the heart of all of this is a storyline. And this is just a snapshot of part of the storyline of my life that is interesting, that is beautiful, like your story. So, at the heart of all of this is you uniquely living this within these frames of reference, and your rule of life is to keep you moving across the storyline without getting lost in either the detail or the chaos. That's a hard thing to do. So I'll pass this around, and you can see something about your story. And it's just a way of symbolizing the beauty of each individual story. Precious, absolutely precious. The other, last week I was in a spot and I met a 101-year-old black woman, Viola. And she was just totally alive, totally alert, totally. And I got to talk to her for a half an hour. And here's 101 years of living on the planet as a black woman. Just beautiful. You know, her story is so beautiful, so unique. It's like that. And we constantly need to be reminded that this huge frame is the great picture, but at the heart of it is that. At the heart of it is that. And so we work with this storyline as our unique silk painting that is brought back from Earth experience and given to heaven. It's a good thing. So
one other off the wall comment. In where do we come from? We Germanic people are very, very good at war.
Very good what?
At war.
Come on, Jim.
since the fall of the Roman Empire.
Yeah, we've been
dominated by Germanic people. And we are very skilled and very interested in our gods that we've created.
Yeah.
So that I think, you know, if that is a valid observation, that tells us that we've got a special problem to deal with.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's a good point. Great point.
No, I'm dealing with this down here. No, I don't think that's a frame in the mind.
Jerry?
Did you say anything about the Star of David?
Yes, the Star of David is the integration of heaven and earth, human and divine. Yeshua, before we have the doctrine of the incarnation as a formal doctrine in Christianity, only unique to Jesus, by the way, in the West, we had the idea that heaven and earth come together. That is part of the contemplating. Human and the divine must exist as a united singleness, unfragmented whole, monachos. That is the vision of Jesus. Whether it was absolutely unique to him, I don't know, but it feels like he made that happen. And he lived it. And as Amir was saying, I mean, what was striking to me, and I heard this in the Middle East, a Westerner will come with their Western skepticism, and you'll go to Iran, and you'll say, well, I don't think Jesus did this, and they'll go, what? What's wrong with you? Of course he did that. You go, really? Yeah, he did that all the time. Okay. So you heard that. You heard it coming through his language, and I chuckled as I watched you listen to him. And I said, okay, you guys get to experience this too. So that's enough of this mandala, but I believe that is what makes a rule of life possible. All of this. And again, it's not an easy integration because we live in a very complicated world. And yet we're tasked to walk through it with integrity and to create communities of support. So if we were all doing this alone, it would just be daunting. But to hear your integration and hear your way of working and your story and the complexities of your world being integrated in the unique, beautiful silk painting of your life, that's great. And that's why interiorized monasticism is not without community, but it's not cloistered. So we come together once a year here to remind ourselves that we belong to each other and to something larger than ourselves. We meet on a regular basis in our own communities for the same reason, to support one another as we do this work, to hold each other up in the priesting of the world, to become integral in our own way as monks. So that's what we're doing. So let's take maybe a few questions,
or comments. Just an observation. When we met in January and began to prepare for this gathering and our request for you to re-examine your rule of life, we ourselves took on the opportunity, the joy of re-examining our old rule. I had to really dig to find mine. So it had been neglected. It hadn't been attended to. And when I reviewed it, some parts really struck me. Wow, I didn't continue on this. And others lay dormant, either unattended to or no longer important. But the other thing that we did as we asked each other to redo, re-examine, and come prepared ourselves. We have shared our rules with one another. I now know Anne's rule, I know Lynn's current rule, I know Blake's. And in being aware of their rule, I can support more fully. I've always thought of my rule as my personal rule, and it is as I've developed it. But in sharing it, and sharing theirs, I have a responsibility now to them to support that rule. So I have a different sense of the rule and its importance, not only in developing it, but in sharing it. And then, if I'm going to share it, now, if they're going to support me, I've got to be accountable now to them to actually get out of what I wrote down. Oh, man. Mm-hmm. Now, this is the world I've created for myself. Both asking for support and being accountable, which I wasn't before. So I just add that because this has just, for me, been a revelation that came out of since January and walking through the process. Offer it for what it's worth. For your own development of your rule, and what do you want to do with it, as well as it be your own guide, in either sharing or feeling like you want to be accountable to someone else to do this.
That's great. Wonderful. It's a wonderful reminder, and it brought something to mind, but Anne, you do.
Ron ended up with what I was going to say. But it's your personal rule of life. You are not responsible to anybody else but yourself for this rule. If you choose to share it, and you want the support, that's fine. If you want to keep it as your own intimate creation, then that's fine too. So don't feel like you have to, that it's part of a communal bank. It's not. It's your thing.
A metaphor came to mind, and it applies to both what Ron and Anna said. Last night I made a Persian dish, which is something called tas kebab, and it's kind of an odd dish. But you can make a lot of it, and you don't have to spend a lot of it. You can put it in the oven, and
it was good.
Thank you. Oh, that's okay. But here's the point. It had prunes in it. Yeah,
prunes. It was good.
Okay, and apricots. Okay, here's the point. Some Persian recipes I've integrated. I don't have to look at them. They are now so internalized that I can go right to the kitchen and make them without consulting the recipe. If you want to cook that, I need to give you the recipe.
Yes.
Because I might, in fact, drop out something to my explanation to you that is vital to it just because I just can't remember that was in the recipe. In the tas kebab one, I needed to remind myself, what's all in that? There's so many layers in that. And what were the outstanding spice things that contribute to that. It was not internalized. I had to visit my rule of life on tas kebab. I probably could have done it without, but I sure enjoyed going back and looking at the original Persian recipe. I think that's what rule of life is. I think, and especially when we share it, maybe you don't want anybody to cook the way you cook. Maybe you want to have it as a secret recipe. That's okay too. But if we do share, then it's here's the things that I'm working with. Some of them come to fore, some of them drop back, some of them are brought forward by this part of the river that I'm paddling through. I need to break out the life jacket, and I need, you know, a big gulp of beer and whatever it is that I need at this moment on the river. And then something else emerges because of the nature of the journey that I'm on.
If you're on my boat, you got your life jacket on all the time.
Spoken like a wise river person.
Been thrown out and had to drift back down the river.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I think that's enough. I have another... We made enough copies. If you wrote over yours and you want a clean copy of this mandala, they're right there. So if you want that, that's great. So in 15 minutes, we'll gather in groups.